Tonight we're going to have a speaker. He comes from Georgia. And we'll let him get up here and tell us his story.
Big Book meeting in Dothan, Alabama. And I'm a Big Book thumper. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim Powers. And I've been called a lot worse than a Big Book thumper, I can tell you that. My sobriety date's February 18, 2002, and I am a member of the Central Orlando Group in Orlando, Florida. I happen to be in Randolph County, Georgia right now due to some circumstances beyond my control, which is about all of the circumstances in my life today, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But what happened was I found a group over in Eufaula. It's about 30 miles away from my house, and they adopted me, and so I go to the Eufaula group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I'm a real history buff also, and to find out that that group was started because a drunk woman in Eufaula read Jack Alexander's article in the Saturday Evening Post. And then she got on a bus and went to Montgomery, Alabama, went to the Prattville Insane Asylum. AA members brought meetings into her there, and then she brought the meeting back to Eufaula. So it's really kind of a cool place for me to wind up. I never know where I'm going to be. God's got me going all over the place. I'm going to tell you what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. That's what the book tells me to do. And so I'll start with, I came from a really good family. My parents were not alcoholics at all. My dad was a commander in the Air Force and an Air Force hero during World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. He had six children. I was the fifth out of six. I was the second son, and I had a little brother who was 10 years younger than me come along and interrupt all my attention getting. I was an alcoholic from the time I was born. I know that today. We moved around a lot. We were always, every couple of years, we were picking up and moving. I was just getting to know people, getting to be friends, and we were moving to another base. And that was because my dad was really good at what he did. He was in big demand, and so we were moving a lot. And that didn't have anything to do with why I became an alcoholic. I look back over my life when I did my inventory, and not just my drinking life, but my whole life, and I realized way before I got into alcohol, I was a liar, a cheater, and a thief. I tell the story that when I was 10 years old, we were in Tacoma, Washington, and three of us were coming home from elementary school, and there were some woods we cut through, and we caught a little field mouse. We were playing with it, and one of my friends got bit on the finger, and for some reason he kept the mouse in his lunchbox and took it home. And of course, word of mouth, all of a sudden his mom's calling my mom, and my mom's saying, did you get bit by that mouse? And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is a get out of school free card here. I said, yes, I did. And then I realized what I had done because of the panic that was setting in. This was in the early 60s. I hate to age myself. So I did not get to go out of school. What I got to do is get rabies shots. And that was simply because I lied. I mean, I didn't have a bite on me. I kept saying, no, I really didn't. But once it came out, there was no taking it back. And so, back then they had to cut the mouse's head off and send it to Washington, D.C. There wasn't any place local. So there's 14 shots and a rabies shot, and you want to talk about pain. I wound up only having to get 11 before we found out there was nothing wrong with the mouse that didn't bite me in the first place. Man, how stupid can you get sometimes? The next year we moved to Duluth, Minnesota, and if you ever have a chance to visit there, don't. It is the coldest place in the world. It's right on Lake Superior. And my oldest sister got married. I was 11 years old, and the colonel said that everybody in the family could have a sip of champagne that was coming out of that fountain. And so all my brothers and sisters got their little cups, and I got my little cup, and everybody took a sip, except for me. I threw that thing back and swallowed it, and something happened to me that did not happen to my sisters and did not happen to anybody else that I know of. I had a feeling that's described by some as that golden moment and things like that. That wasn't my feeling. My feeling was more. I want more. And I spent the next 30-something years chasing more. And it was not fun for a long time, and I continued to do it anyway. The Moors made me go back by that fountain and get another one with nobody looking, and then I went back, and then I had about five or six in me, and an 11-year-old boy spinning around on the floor, and they went and put me to bed. And the next morning I woke up, and y'all have probably heard it before, I was covered in puke and pee, and I had a hangover I describe as a little man in my head with a sledgehammer and an anvil just banging away. And it was just a horrible feeling. And I'm an alcoholic. I couldn't wait to do it again. I could not wait to get that feeling again. We moved to Orlando, Florida about a year later, and I got to hanging out with some guys about 5 years older than me, and they wanted to do the same thing as me. They wanted to be hammered all the time, and so I didn't like school. School didn't know I was around very much because I never went. And what happened is I started getting put in juvenile homes, and that was the start. I became a burglar along with my friends to pay for my alcohol. And I'll stop right here, and I'm going to say this real briefly. During the time that I was being raised, drugs were a big part of my story. But I am a real, real alcoholic. Alcohol was there at the beginning, during, and alcohol was there at the end. And I believe in the traditions very strongly that they've saved this group and saved every group in America and in the world when Bill finally put those traditions into effect. And so I believe in the singleness of purpose, and I'm going to be talking about alcohol, but I did have a lot of extracurricular activities in there too. We burglarized homes without any thought of consequences at all. And I continued to get arrested and put in a juvenile home. There was nobody that ever was smart enough to tell me, Jim, if you put on a pair of gloves, they wouldn't get your fingerprints on all those houses. And but nobody ever told me that. So, you know, every 3 or 4 months, they were coming to pick me up and take me to juvenile home. When I turned 16, just breaking into homes and stealing wasn't good enough for me. And I picked up a pistol and I became an armed robber. You know, for 16 and 17, and that's what I did. I wanted my alcohol and things, and the only way to get it was either work for it, and I wasn't going to work, and I wasn't going to school, and so I started going to jail. I want you all to know I'm not proud of any of this. This is my story. But I never killed anybody, to my knowledge. I know I hurt a lot of people, though. In 16 and 17, I was in and out of the local county lockup. Never hearing about AA. I don't know whether they brought it in or not, but I never heard about it. I was 44 years old before I heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's either you can say I'm on the slow bus, or I just wasn't an alcoholic. I just wasn't. I drank every day for the effects produced by alcohol, but I wasn't an alcoholic. And when I came into the rooms, I wasn't an alcoholic. I got out of jail and proceeded to do an armed robbery and get charged with a whole bucket load of felonies and get arrested again. And I was 17 years old. And I wrote my dad a letter, and I call it the alcoholic letter because I meant every word of it. I was locked up. I had no clue what was going to happen. And I wrote him this four-page letter swearing, I will never, ever do this again. I will never break in. I will never rob. I'm never going to do any of this stuff again. And I meant it. I really did. And the day he bonded me out, that night when he went to bed, I broke into his gun case. I stole the .45 automatic he carried through 3 wars. I went over the back wall of our house, and I took off to California. And now I'm interstate flight to avoid prosecution, and I'm doing armed robberies all across the southeast United States. Get to California, and because of those extracurricular activities, I've got serum hepatitis. The guys that are with me, I'm turning orange in the car with them. And so I'm 17. I have a military dependence card. So they pull up to an Air Force base out in San Rafael, California, and they kind of pushed me out of the car at the emergency room exit. And the first orderly that came up and looked at me, they immediately rushed me into isolation. And I was in there for between 6 weeks and, I don't know, could be 2 months, could be 9 months. I can't remember. All I can remember is I almost died. I came very close to dying at that time. So when I was released from there, now I'm wanted in Orlando. And I have a wanted poster at the Navy base in Orlando in the PX. But I'm at an Air Force base in California, and they don't communicate like they do nowadays. You know, nowadays I'd have been arrested out there. I got out of there, and a friend of mine and I decided we'd take a run across the northern states. And so we went from California to Minnesota, doing armed robberies all the way up there, not getting caught. I was arrested in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on some other charges, but they were dropped. I got out of town very quickly, and I flew back to Orlando for a party that a friend of mine was having. At that party, the police had an informant there, and they knew I was coming, and they had been looking for me pretty hard. They came and raided the party when I was there. I had injected a whole bunch of phenocycladine. I was in my second round of serum hepatitis without knowing it at the time, and I was drunk. And I was drunk and crazy, and I had a gun in my hand when they came through the door. And recently the man who had the gun pointed at me while we had a standoff, which is unheard of. Me being able to stand there pointing a gun at a SWAT officer, and him not shooting me, you know. And when he retired as the chief of the Maitland Police Department, I went up to him and made amends and said, "Why didn't you shoot?" And he said, "I don't know. You know, you were pointing a gun at me. I should have blown you away." And he still remembered it all those years later. God doing for me way before I knew that God was in my life. My family was not in religion. The only time the commander and my mother would dress us up is to show us off, maybe at Easter or at Thanksgiving or Christmas. They'd dress all the family members up and we'd go up to church. But that was the only church. So I had no God in my life. I had no religious upbringing. And so this program was custom made for me. When I came here and I finally did what was a requirement is in that book. And that was for me to be able to put the drink down, and I wasn't able to do that for a while. I got married. Oh, man, did I jump ahead fast. That night when they arrested me, they took me back to Orange County Jail. I went before a judge 2 weeks later. I'm in an isolation cell with hepatitis again, and I'm 18 years old, and the judge says that I don't have any redeeming qualities. And he sentenced me to 52 years in the state penitentiary in Rayford, Florida, which is a maximum security penitentiary. And I knew I was going to die. I knew it. And the only book that was in that isolation cell was a Bible. I never read the Bible. But by God, something happened, because when I went back in that cell, I grabbed that book. And for 2 weeks, while I was waiting to be transferred, I held on to that book and I prayed. And I said, "Please, God, please don't let this happen." And 2 weeks later, the judge called me back in and said, "You have some redeemable qualities after all." I don't know what changed his mind. I would say it's God. But he sentenced me to 18 months on a chain gang. And if y'all have ever seen the movie Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman, that's what a chain gang is. Now, when you see prisoners out on the highway today, they got weed eaters and blowers and, you know, that's not work. Let me tell you, when you have a swing blade in the ditch 6 days a week, sun up to sundown, that's work. And the first month that I came out of the isolation cell and went on the chain gang, I fell out every day. And when you fell out, they didn't call the ambulance and take you to the emergency room. They picked you up, put you underneath the truck, and you laid there for the entire day until you could get back in the truck and go back to the camp. Now, I'm not the fastest person on the block, but I'm not that dumb either. You know, I was born in Georgia, and it's some kind of inherited thing that you ought to know how to make moonshine or homemade booze when you're born in Georgia. I don't know. But I knew how to make it. And so all I could see when I'm out on that road is, be good, be good, be good. And you can be a trustee, and you can get out of the ditch. You can sharpen the blades, you don't have to swing them. Be good a little bit more, and they'll put you in the building. And you can go to the kitchen. You be good in the kitchen, they can make you a cook. And by God, that's what I did. And when you're in a kitchen feeding 150 people three meals a day, the ingredients are in that kitchen. And I used to tell you what the ingredients were, and my sponsor said, "Quit doing that." trust me, the ingredients are there. You put it in a can, you put it on a top shelf. And to prove I'm an alcoholic, we use the rotten grapefruit that's laid on the ground that turned gray and they're all dusty, if you've ever seen those. Well, that's what we use for filler, to help ferment. And so after a couple of weeks of sitting up there, you drain it through a sock. I don't remember if it was a clean sock. It didn't matter. And you could get the effect produced by alcohol. And that's exactly what I did. And there was never any thought in my mind that I have a problem. Nobody ever said, maybe you need to go to rehab. Maybe you need to go to, detox. I've never been to rehab drunk. I've never been to detox or emergency room drunk. I've taken a lot of people to detox and to rehab and to the emergency room doing 12-step calls. That's my life. And it's the life that God gave me. I got off the chain gang. I did my probation. I wasn't quite over stealing, but I didn't get caught. I moved to a little town. I was talking to the other visitor here from Prattville. I moved to a little town in Columbus, Mississippi, and met my future ex-wife. And didn't know it at that time, but I met her in a drunken haze. I thought I fell in love, and it starts with the same word, the same letter, but then love. But she stayed with me for 21 years. And God bless that woman, because I drank every day to get drunk. I drank to black out every day. Now, I kept jobs, so I could be an alcoholic. I didn't ever lose everything. I didn't live under a bridge. I don't own a trench coat. I can't be an alcoholic. That's my idea of an alcoholic, okay, when I came in. We moved back to Orlando. She and I got married. And it took 17 years before she was able to carry a child to full childbirth. And I have a little boy named Forrest. That little boy named Forrest was born a month premature. And she and I at the time were not agreeing on very much. It was my late stage alcoholism. And she wanted to name him Austin. My last name's Powers. I'm glad that didn't happen. I wanted to name him Seamus, which is, Irish for Jim, and she didn't like that name. She thought he'd be teased. We went and saw the movie Forrest Gump, and we agreed that that was a pretty cool name, so we named him Forrest. Now, you gotta watch that movie three or four times before you figure out who Forrest Gump is named after. His great-great-granddaddy was the leader of the Ku Klux Klan. missed that one. It was just a nice name. And I can tell you today, my son has been to thousands of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. He's 19 years old. He doesn't drink. He doesn't do drugs. He is the greatest kid in the world. And most of what he's learned in life has been learned sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, open meetings only, because I am a traditionalist. If it was a closed meeting, he had to sit outside or sit at the coffee bar or something like that. My home group's got a separate area where there's a coffee bar at. And he would sit there, and he learned about life that way. Now, coming up to me coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in full-blown alcoholism. And my back was hurting me. My favorite sister was dying from multiple myeloma, which is a bone marrow disease. And I had back pain from when I was young. And she said, well, I've got some back pain medicine. Would you like some of them? And I said, yes, I would. And so I took some of those one night, and I drank a lot of alcohol. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, this crazy woman is standing over me on my bed, screaming at me, you're peeing all over me, you're peeing all over me. And that's a lie. I was peeing all over me, and she was getting the effects produced by alcohol. She didn't think it was funny, and I didn't think it was funny. And the very next day, to make amends to that, I went out and bought a brand new mattress for her. And this was not a dumb girl. She went out and spent $20 on a plastic mattress cover. She thought this was going to happen again. And she was right. It happened a few more times before she decided that she wanted to live in a different part of the house, and our marriage went to hell. She came to me one day and she said, I want a divorce. I was drunk, and I said, what do you want? She said, everything. And I said, I'll give it to you. So I did. I signed my divorce papers in a drunken stupor, not knowing that what I had just done was giving away the one thing that meant more to me than anything in my life, my son. I gave my son up to be raised by another man two states away because I wanted to stay in the bottle. And I've made amends to my son, and I can tell you this, he is the greatest stepfather in the world. And I'm really glad that that happened. She and I agreed to get a divorce. We were going to be very cordial about it. We weren't going to trash each other. The very next day, I walked into my dad's house. My dad and my stepmom were standing there, and the look on their face said, I have already been trashed. She went over and told them what I was doing. And I knew my stepmother worked for the Hillsborough County Court System. That's in Tampa. I never asked her what she did. For 28 years, she was the lady that you had to go see if you were caught driving while intoxicated, and she would tell you how many AA meetings you had to go get your paper signed at. What a small world, you know? So small that she looked at me and said, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and your wife needs to go to Al-Anon. And my wife said, I don't have a problem. And I said, I'm not an alcoholic. I get up and go to work every day. This is just a little, you know, little fluke that's happening here, and we'll correct that somehow or another. So anyway, I was not coming to AA. I had no intention whatsoever. And a friend of mine, that was my love bug. What are you taking my bugs away for? Come up here and hit me and hey, what just happened down here in Alabama? A friend of mine got tough loved out of his house. He was 4 years younger than me. They told him, don't come home anymore if you're drunk. And on the back road of a little community outside of Orlando, he got totally hammered one night, and he set his car on fire and committed suicide. And his family found the car the next day, and there was nothing left but the rims and the metal. And I went to his funeral, and you know, my life right then is getting this divorce. I'm drinking an awful lot, and somebody's telling me I need to go to AA. I don't know why. And something happened at that funeral. Something came over me, and I can only tell you it's the hand of God. Because the very next day I called a friend of mine who I knew was a counselor, and I said, I think I need to go to a meeting. I need to go to one meeting and tell these drunks that if they don't quit drinking, you know, they're going to kill themselves. You know, I'm so smart, you know. And he says, you know that building right across the street from your office? That's an AA meeting. And I go, the labor pool? And he goes, it's not a labor pool. Every morning when I drive by at 6:30 to go to my office, all these people were standing outside and drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, and I thought, what a strange place to have a labor pool. It was their 6 o'clock meeting as I was driving by, and I had no clue. So I walked across the street at noon that day. I walked in, I sat down. They started the meeting. They knew I was a newcomer, even though I didn't raise my hand, and they called on me to share, and I shared my wisdom. And a guy came after me to the meeting. I got up and I left that meeting, and a guy came after me, and he said, just don't drink today and come back tomorrow. Just try not to drink today and come back tomorrow. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And I wasn't going back. And the next day at noon, I have no explanation why I walked across that street and walked into that meeting. And they called on me again. It must be, you know, call on gym time. And I burst out in tears and said, I can't quit drinking. And that's when I really knew I had a problem. And for 27 days, I would swear I was not going to drink. I meant every fiber. I'd go to the meeting, I'd cry. Yes, I drank last night. I'm not going to do it today. I'm going to pray. I never heard get a sponsor. Yeah, I never heard work the steps. I had selective hearing, I'm told now. I didn't know it at the time. I heard what I wanted to hear and disregarded the rest. And for 27 days, I went into that room every day saying, I can't quit drinking. And there was an older Jewish man there named Leo. And he had survived 5 years in the concentration camps. And I didn't know it at the time that he had 30-something years. But he came up to me and he said, why don't you go home today and just drink a bottle of arsenic and get it over quickly? Because I'm tired of seeing yourself kill yourself slowly. And that man pissed me off so much that for the first time in over 30 years, I went home and I didn't drink and I didn't take any other mind-altering thing. And I went back the next day and picked up a white chip. I started my recovery on a resentment. Let me give anybody, if you don't understand why they're laughing, because if you start your recovery on a resentment, you're not going to stay in recovery. And for the next 3.5 years, I went in and out of the rooms because I could not get step two. I could not admit that I was crazy. And step two said I have to be restored to sanity. So that means I have to be insane, and I'm not. I get up every morning, I go to work, I work hard, I don't have the DTs, I don't shake. 5 o'clock in the afternoon when I'm driving home, I'm picking up Schlitz malt liquor until I get home, and, you know, I've got a bottle at the house, I drink until I pass out. You know, Bill writes in the story that the body's a marvelous mechanism, and it is. You know, I don't know how many of y'all know that when you black out, it's your body telling itself, I got to stop this guy before he kills him. It's a way of alcohol poisoning stopping you from killing yourself. And I didn't do that. I had no clue about that. In and out for 3.5 years. I would get periods of what I call dry time. I would pray. I would do everything in my power. And I would go to meetings. And things were going good. Things were going good. And when things were going good, Jim overstated that problem. And so I can have a drink. I can do this. And then they wouldn't see me for 2 or 3 weeks, and I'd start getting phone calls on my recorder. Hey, Jim, you know, we're not seeing you. We hope you're okay. And I wouldn't be answering the phone. And finally, it would get so bad, I'd just, in humiliation, I'd go back in there and pick up a white chip. And then they'd say, you got a sponsor? And I said, yes, I do. What's his name? Well, he doesn't want me to tell you what his name is. Does he? What step are you on? 4-step. How's that going? Oh, that's tough. It's tough. Y'all figured out I'm sponsoring myself, right? Sick man sponsoring a sick man. Nobody's getting well. I went 9 months without a drink. I went 9 months. And a friend of mine called me up and said, let's go to a speaker meeting and you can pick up your 9-month chip tonight. And I went, yeah, that sounds great. And so we go to the speaker meeting, and this guy gets up there, I've never met before, and he starts telling my story, including Schlitz malt liquor. And I'm like, I thought I was the only one who drank Schlitz malt liquor. I mean, it's just, nothing racist about it. It's just, well, I wanted the effect produced by alcohol. And he tells my story all the way. And at the end, you know, I've been bobbing my head like a doll in the back of the car. My friend goes, hey, why don't you go up and shake Joe's hand and tell him thanks? And I didn't know I'd been set up the whole time. And, you know, my group's a pretty large group, and people get around the speaker and start talking to him, and I'm like, he's busy, I'll get to him later on. And my friend goes, no, he's not busy. And he just parts everybody out like Moses in the Red Sea. And he leads me up to this guy, and he says, hey, Joe, this is my friend Jim. He needs a sponsor. Oh. So I shake Joe's hand, I tell him that he told my story, I really appreciate it, and would he sponsor me? And he said, well, I don't know, are you done drinking? And I said, yeah, I haven't had a drink in 9 months, I'm done. And so I take out my business card, on the white side on the back, I write down my phone number, I hand it to Joe, and I say, call me Monday if you want to sponsor me. Joe takes out his business card, and on the white side, on the back side, he writes down his phone number, and he says, call me Monday if you want me to sponsor you. We turned those two business cards over. We worked for the same real estate company in two different divisions. I've never met the man before in my life. And you want to talk about, there is no coincidence. That man was meant for me. The next day was Sunday. I got up. I went to the 10 a.m. Sunday morning meeting. I was feeling great on the way home. My truck pulled into an ABC parking lot. I walked into an ABC store. I bought a half gallon of liquor because I'm going to have one drink. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to have one drink. And maybe in 4 or 5 years I might want another drink. So I might as well buy the big bottle now. You know, not the little one drink bottles. Economy. Alkalogic is what one of my friends talked about. So I remember pouring that one drink. I remember going home and pouring that one drink, saying, I can drink one drink before I start this sponsee thing. And I don't remember anything else that happened that night. And when I came to the next morning, laying on my kitchen floor, I was covered in blood, I was covered in pee, and I didn't know who I had hit, who I had killed, what I had done. And half that bottle was gone, and I had no clue what happened. None. I only remember pouring the first drink. After about 15 minutes, I was able to ascertain that I had hit my head passing out on the kitchen table, and I very easily could have bled out. I have buried numerous members of my home group that have done the exact same thing and have died because they decided they didn't need the program anymore. They were well enough that they could go out and do that. I called Joe, and Joe said, all right, go to your noon meeting, pick up a white chip. I just picked up a 9-month chip. You want me to pick up a white chip? Yeah, you drank. And I'm like, okay. And I said, we'll meet. And that was February 18th, 2002. And that day we started doing the first 3 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can tell you, Joe did not want me sitting around thinking about anything. As soon as we were done with step 3, he said, start writing your inventory. And I started writing my inventory. And there were things I was not going to tell anybody. I mean, I would go to my grave with these things. You know? And in the big book it says, in the 5th step, that, you know, if we don't tell somebody all our life story, we might not get over the drink problem. And so when Joe and I met to go over my 4th step, doing my 5th step, he told me a little bit about his, and the first thing he did, you know, I got my papers out, and the first thing he did was, just tell me what you're never going to tell me. Just tell me what you're never going to tell anybody first, and then we'll go over what you wrote down. And I just blurted out the things that I swore I'd take to my grave. And he knew exactly how to work the program and work me. Because once I did that, the freeing aspect of doing that was unbelievable to me. 6 and 7, they're simply prayers. You know, they're just prayers in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before they wrote the 12 and 12, those things were done immediately. After you did the 5th step, after you took the hour, after you reviewed the first 5 proposals, you immediately did 6 and 7 and started writing 8. This is not a program of sitting around and thinking about it. It's a program of action. Designed for living. We all know that if you're studying the book. And it works in all cases. You know, there's only 2 kinds of people that aren't going to get this thing. And it says it right there in how it works. Those who cannot and those who will not. And those are the only 2. Because I know constitutionally incapable people who are sober today because they surrendered. And that's the biggest thing in my life today is every day I have to still surrender beyond the surrender. I surrendered my alcoholism at first. But then I have to surrender everything else in my life, every day. You know, and that's how I do it, one day at a time. I don't project into the future. I got very involved with my home group. I got very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met a gentleman after I moved to Georgia the first time. My dream was to move to Randolph County, Georgia. And if you know anything about Randolph County, Georgia, that's not a real good dream. You know, it's a pretty poor community, and there's no work there, but that's okay. I found 46 acres. My older brother agreed to buy it with me, build a couple houses, and I opened a real estate company up in Randolph County, Georgia. The day, I want you to know this, the day the real estate market crashed, I opened a real estate company. I still have a ways to go in my thinking. I was up there struggling in that real estate. I spent an awful lot of money doing that, and I was struggling in that, and I got a phone call one day out of the blue from somebody that I don't even know. Some girl called from Orlando and said, your brother, my little brother, he's in the intensive care in a coma right now. And you know, the person that we know that reach is your sister, and she's in Hawaii. And I said, well, I'll be right there. She said, well, the last thing he said before he went in a coma was, don't call my brother Jim. He had gotten his 5th felony DUI, and I had tough-loved him I'm the trustee of my father's estate. My father died 7 days after I got sober, and I didn't have to drink. And so I tough-loved him a little bit. And after his fifth DUI, he had to wear a monitoring bracelet on his ankle that didn't do GPS stuff. It monitored his sweat glands. And it would set off an alarm at his parole office that he was consuming alcohol. And part of the condition of his parole or his probation was he'd do 5 years in state penitentiary if he was caught doing alcohol during that probation period. So he didn't drink. He hadn't drank for over a year. And so this girl said that, we got to have a family member down here. And I said, I'll be right down. And she said, I just want you to know something. I'm a friend of Bill W.'s, and I've heard you speak before. And I knew I had a friend watching over my brother right then. So I got my affairs in order. It took me about a day, and then I went down there. He came out of the coma. I took him to all his radiation. He had 10 tumors on his liver, lungs, pancreas, brain, and it gave him 6 months, 2 years to live. And so we made a bucket list, and I went to his parole or probation department, and I got them to cut off the bracelet. I got him freed of all his probation obligations because of the doctor's reports. And on the way back, I said, why don't we stop in a noon meeting at Central, and we did. And he lasted about half a meeting, and he said, I'm really hungry. Can we go get something to eat? And I said, yeah. And he stopped at the place where he worked, and the first thing he did was order a glass of wine. And I said, you know, based on my experience and what I've seen, this is a really bad idea. This is a really bad idea. You've got 6 months, maybe 2 years. We've got a lot of things we wrote down that we're going to do. If you start drinking, all bets are going to be off. I'm just going to have a glass of wine, Jim. Okay. On the way home from the restaurant, he said, can you stop by the ABC so I can get a bottle of wine? I just want something to take the edge off every now and then. I'm like, this is a bad idea. But I can't stop anybody from doing it. You know, I couldn't stop my little brother. I came back up to Georgia. It was going to be about 3 weeks for him to get healed up from all the radiation. And that little girl called me again and said, they're admitting him to the emergency room right now. He's blown out a ulcer. And I started heading to Florida. And I get to Valdosta, and I get a report, you know, what do you want him to do? And I said, well, he doesn't want to be on life support. What are they doing? Oh, he's on a ventilator. And I'm like, oh, geez. And finally, I get to Gainesville, and it's looking real bad. And I asked this person if she'd go get a priest, and if they'd give him his last rites. And he put the cell phone on his chest so I could be a part of it. I got to Orlando at 11:30 that night. He was alive. He was unconscious. I mean, the machine was breathing for him. And I was pretty upset. And I told the nurse, what the hell is this ventilator doing on somebody who has a DNR? And she said, well, that's the way he came up from the emergency room through the operating room. And you'll have to wait till the morning to talk to the administrators to get that tube removed. And I said, not if God's listening. And my brother was so bloated and cold. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was holding his hand, and he took his last breath. And he flatlined. Even though that machine was still pumping air, his heart stopped. And that really tore me up. I mean, it tore me up bad. I moved back to Orlando. My brother was fine living up here in Georgia. I would come up every month, and I have a nickname called Georgia Jim. That's on that flyer back there. And it's because during September, October, November, December, and January, people would come in, and I go to a meeting, two meetings a day, you know, because I want to down in Orlando. We have five a day at my home group. And people would not see me for a day, and they'd say, where's Jim? And everybody would go, Georgia. So whenever I go back, it's Georgia Jim's back in town. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So, you know, I went back into my real estate career down there. I had some trouble with that. I got into bankruptcy. I took some money and decided to be an over-the-road trucker. I don't know how to change the oil in the vehicle, and I'm going to get behind one of these men. Be careful pissing off those truckers. It could be a student driver. Because I trained down in Florida, and I can tell you, I passed.
And because of the Moors, I said, what's the top, you know, 18-wheel driver thing you can get? And they said, hazmat. And I said, well, let me take that test. And I passed that. And then what I didn't tell you is I'm also a nationally registered emergency medical technician. Now, when I was on the chain gang, I don't remember them bringing any AA meetings in. But they brought in a teacher twice a week. And so to get out of the cell block, I would go take my GED stuff. And I carry the GED around with me right now, because I found it here a couple of years ago. And failing is anything below 70. My highest score was 62. But I have a state-certified, registered, licensed GED. Yeah, I don't know how that happened. No, I'm not supposed to have it, I'm telling you, but I've got it, and it's legal. And then my son challenged me to go into medical school to become an EMT because I stopped in an accident in a place called Gordo, Alabama, and helped save a woman's life. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I can't spell four-letter words very much. But I went there. And I told the paramedic instructors, I said, I'll take the test, and I'll be quiet, and I'll come to class, and I'll pay for it. But I'm not passing this thing. And this one paramedic goes, well, just take this thing one day at a time, and we'll see what happens. Go figure. You know? I came out of that class, you got to take three different classes simultaneously and maintain an 80 or above average. And I came out with two B's and an A, using the GED. So everything I've ever done, I've gone to the school, God's taken the test. Because the God I found in Alcoholics Anonymous has been with me all my life. And I didn't know it until I came in here and was given the opportunity to pick a God of my own choice. That nobody gave me one, nobody told me which one to get. It was a loving, caring, wonderful God that has done more for me than I can even truly believe. The reason I'm in Randolph County right now is a friend of mine asked me to go hunting, and he wanted to talk about his brother. His brother was in the chain gang with me, and his brother was an alcoholic of my type, and had the leg amputated due to diabetes and been in rehab for 3 months and hadn't had any drinks. The guy wanted to know what was going to happen. And I said, he's probably going to get out, get a pocket full of pain pills, go buy a couple gallons of wine, and in a couple weeks you're going to find him dead. Well, what happened was we drove up to my property and I found my older brother dead. And he had been dead for 3 days. And he died from untreated alcoholism. And 3 days after that, my friend's brother overdosed and died. Because I'd seen it happen so many times. So, it was pretty traumatic again, and it took me until April of this year that I could actually come back up to the property, and I realized I can't live in Orlando and on the property at the same time. So I moved back to Georgia to sell the property, and for quite a while, I would talk to, you know, my sponsor told me that God's in charge of selling the property, you're just supposed to be carrying the message. My sponsor is a Scottish man with 28 years sobriety, and he got sober in Scotland, and he got sober in the west of Scotland where they didn't want to talk about the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't want to talk about God. It was Drinkers Anonymous, he called it. So he would send over to the United States for cassette tapes, and then he would produce copies to take them around, Joe and Charlie, different speakers he would buy from a guy in Texas. And the guy would always send him extra, and he would make copies. And so my sponsor started doing this 28 years ago. And he now does this about 14 hours a day. He doesn't get out very much. But as of today, there's over 25,500 free AA speakers on his website. And if anybody wants a card afterwards, I'll give you a card. You can download them for free. We don't ask for money. We don't accept money. This is what we do now is we record speakers. And we videotape long-timers for the archives, and it is just a thrill. I mean, it's a thrill knowing that this lady up in Eufaula will be celebrating 45 years this month, and she was sponsored by the lady who read the Saturday Evening Post. Those are just cool things that happen in my life, you know? I'm involved in Alcoholics Anonymous no matter where I go. I got on that truck in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I trained in Florida, okay? And got in a truck in Chattanooga, Tennessee to start my career as a truck driver. There are mountains in Chattanooga, Tennessee. There are no mountains in Florida. Trust me. They have a place called Mount Door, but it's not a mountain. I'm telling you. So I had a little difficulty shifting gears and pulling 80,000 pounds of hazmat behind me trying to get up a hill, trying to stop it from going down a hill, and then we're going up a hill again. And then we're going through snow up a hill and down a hill, and within a six-week period, I had passed six kidney stones in the back of a truck in a milk jug. You want to talk about pain? I'll tell you about pain. And I got off that truck and went to my doctor, and my doctor said, if you have any use for that ever again, you'll get out of that truck. And so I said, yeah, I don't want to feel that ever again. He said, you're lucky you didn't die. And so my career in trucking ended just as quickly as it started. And I moved back to Orlando, and, you know, when I found my brother, I said, you know, I've got to go up to sell the property, and then I'm going to move back to Orlando. And I'll put God in charge of selling my property, but then I'm going to go back to Orlando. And I realized after I spoke about a week ago somewhere, that what I was doing was I still telling God what I was going to do. I had not completely surrendered. Sure, I surrendered the sale of the property, but then I was telling God I'm going back to Orlando. I did not know where I'm going. When the property sells, I don't know if I'm staying in Randolph County, Eufaula, coming down here to Dothan. I don't have a clue where God's going to put me next. But wherever it is, it's exactly where I'm supposed to be. Because my God's got me right here, right now, where I'm supposed to be. And I know that for a fact. Because without Him, I wouldn't be here. The things I do for fun and free. You know, I talked to one of my cats, I call him, because sometimes when I get four or five of my sponsors calling me at one time, it's like herding cats. It's like, everybody get on page 62. You know, selfish and self-centeredness, that's the root of your problem. And yes, all those troubles she's giving you are of your own making, you know. But I was talking to him as I was coming in here tonight, and he goes, you know, a year and a half ago, when I was locked up in Marchman Acted, which is Baker Act, I don't know what they call it up here, but he was committed. And then came back and he said, would you work with me again? I said, yes. And he said, you know, my biggest problem today is trying to decide what detox center I'm going to take a meeting into tonight. And I said, you got the program. You got the program. Bill Wilson, in one of his last talks, talked about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are not to be worked. They're to be lived in our life. I heard a guy say to his sponsor one time, he says, what do I do when I finish the 12 steps? And he said, you lie very, very still, because you're dead. You don't ever finish working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got that. And I have seen, I can't tell you how many miracles I have seen in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen the tragedies. I've buried good people because I got this. You know, I don't have this. That's why I still study the textbook called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a textbook to be studied and referred back to. And, you know, one of the things I like to read is that there's a little pamphlet that's called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a couple of things in there that are really important. One is people who go to meetings and don't drink thinking that they're going to get something rubbed off on them do. It's called rigor mortis. You will die from untreated alcoholism by going to meetings and not drinking and doing nothing else. If you don't change and you don't implement these steps into your life, the spiritual principles, you're not going to make it. I've never seen anybody. And at the end of the pamphlet, it's kind of sums up a lot of what I believe. This guy writes that more than 16 years ago, four men, my boss, my physician, my pastor, and one friend I had left, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into AA. Tonight, if they were to ask me, tell us, what did you find? I'd say to them what I say to you now. I can only tell you what I have heard and seen. It seems that the blind do see.
the lame do walk, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. I grant that it always be so. The end of the foreword of the third edition says that every day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And I hope I've done that tonight. Thanks.